The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 25/May 2, 2022, bordered in red with an inner border of white, Time in large block letters, capitalized, is in white, superimposed upon the green of a tree that is growing out of a conference table surrounded by four chairs and behind which stands a woman in professional dress, suit, it would appear. And it says Earth, Inc. Turning now to an article from this issue. Education. Why college rejections are not always bad news, by S. Mitra Kalita, who is co-founder and CEO of URL Media, publisher of Epicenter NYC, and columnist for Charter in partnership with Time. In the spring of 1994, I cried over being denied admission at Northwestern and Columbia and three other elite universities. A close friend failed to console me by saying, "Rejection builds character," but she was right. Nearly three decades later, I trace so much of who I am and the career I have built to that awful week. Rutgers, where I ended up, was huge, and there was a need to prove myself, quickly define what I stood for, and distinguish myself from the crowd. I now realize the string of rejections left a bit of a chip on my shoulder and forced me to compensate for a lack of pedigree. This constant hustle proved invaluable in both traditional career ascension and my more recent entrepreneurial endeavors. Over the past few weeks, millions of high school students learned their own college admission fates. Today, it is harder than ever to get into a selective college or university. The trend line, ironically, comes as enrollment at U.S. colleges is plummeting. Meanwhile, employers like IBM, facing labor shortages, dangle six-figure offers and training programs to high school graduates. Here is what college admission experts advise when things do not quite work out. Do not take rejection personally. Most experts agree record application numbers hastened by test optional policies mean there is no way for overwhelmed admissions offices to take the time applications deserve. Yours maybe got 8 minutes of their time and 2 minutes in a committee room, if they discussed you at all, says Ron Lieber, author of The Price You Pay for College. Anecdotally, experts say there's a high number of students on wait lists this year. The waiting game is tough, but look at it another way. The graduating classes of high school and college have experienced unprecedented uncertainty in their young lives. The resulting resilience is a major asset for employers. Not all decisions are in your hands, but one thing in your control is your character. The first question Lafiz Lakhani, founder and president of Lakhani Coaching, a college admission prep and consulting firm, asks clients is, how are you doing in cultivating a fulfilling high school career? There's often confusion. Fulfilling to whom? Admissions officers? Parents? Then you see their eyes open up because they realize you must be fulfilling to you first, and then others will notice, Lakhani says. That is not to say those rejected from their dream schools had no character, but for both those who got in and those who did not, it is wise to spend some time figuring out your character story, Lakhani says. The question of what you stand for is asked at life's every turn, to get into classes, clubs, grad school, jobs, the boardroom. Where to find that purpose? A gap year could help here. Research has shown that gap year students get in less trouble, are more likely to graduate on time, and have higher GPAs, which in turn can lead to stronger job opportunities, Lieber writes. Jeffrey Salengo writes in his book, Who Gets In and Why?, that graduates of so-called elite schools versus state universities are barely distinguishable. For 40 years, top-ranked institutions have sold us on these distinctions, telling prospective students and their families that the brand name on the degree is what matters most when it comes to success after college. For economists, it's a much more nuanced answer than before. Majors and skills might count for more in the job market than the college itself. Employers are also rethinking elite institutions. For ages, the best internships went to students and graduates of top 20 colleges. That is changing as diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts extend to the source of recruitment, looking beyond the Ivy League. Parents should also look beyond admissions. What if we focused less on admissions and instead on how to make high school as fulfilling as possible, or considered alternative options for the road ahead? If we teach our young people they're no less because of rejection and no more because of an admission, says Becky Munster-Sobke, author of Valedictorians at the Gate, it can remind them what matters most is not the name on their college sweatshirt, but who is wearing it. The next article is an essay, Follow the Money. I Learned the Hard Way What Russia's President Cares About Most, by Bill Browder. There's a photo here. It's distorted, probably purposefully. It appears to be the face of Vladimir Putin, but there's a red target in front of it. This face is, by the way, in tones of gray, not even any white, off-white and various shades of gray. And in the center of the target, the small center, is a portrait of another person's face. It's Sergei Magnitsky, who was murdered after documenting corruption in Putin's government. This illustration is attributed to Lincoln Agnew for Time. As we watch the murderous carnage that Putin has unleashed against innocent Ukrainians, we're all trying to understand his motivations. Some say he's reacting to NATO expansion. Others contend Putin cannot abide a Western-leaning Ukraine. Still others offer Putin so laments the breakup of the Soviet Union that he wants to reassemble it. From my perspective, it is not due to any of these reasons. It is simply about money. Unlike most other governments, Russia is not there to serve the people, but to enrich senior officials through endemic corruption. The more senior you are, the richer you get. And the most senior person, Vladimir Putin, has become the richest. I estimate his wealth to be well north of $200 billion. I have seen how Russian corruption works with my own eyes. For a decade, between 1996 and 2005, I ran the largest foreign investment firm in Russia. My business model was simple. Buy deeply undervalued shares in Russian companies, expose these companies' corruption, then watch their share prices rise as the companies were forced to clean up. It worked like a charm. However, as you can imagine, the oligarchs and corrupt officials who were doing the stealing were not too happy with me. In November 2005, I was kicked out of the country and declared a threat to Russian national security. I moved to London and regrouped with my small team. We also went about liquidating the fund's Russian assets. In 2006, our holding companies reported a profit of $1 billion, paying $230 million in taxes to the Russian Treasury. I was done with Russia, but Russia was not done with me. In 2007, my office in Moscow was raided by the Russian Interior Ministry. All our documents were seized, and these were used to perpetrate a highly complex tax rebate fraud scheme to steal $230 million from the Russian Treasury that our investment holding companies had previously paid. My lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, discovered the crime, testified against the officials involved, and in retaliation was arrested. He was held for 358 days, tortured, and killed November 16, 2009, in Russian police custody. He was only 37 years old. He left behind a wife, a 7-year-old son, and a loving mother. Since then, it's been my life's mission to get justice for Sergei. Unfortunately, it was impossible to get justice in Russia. The Russian government promoted the people who killed Sergei, giving them state honors. 3 years after Sergei's murder, the Russian government put him on trial in the first ever case against a dead man in Russian history. This story is a microcosm of what happens every day in Russia. You need to multiply the crime that Sergei discovered by 1,000 to begin to appreciate how much has been stolen by Putin and his cronies. The problem for Putin is that this level of corruption is unsustainable. Russia presents itself as a democracy to its people, and those people are the ones deprived of health care, education, paved roads, and a decent standard of living, so that senior officials in the Putin regime can enjoy yachts, private jets, and villas in the south of France. No matter what Russian propagandists peddle, eventually people will get angry. Putin looked around, and what he saw frightened him. In Kazakhstan, another corrupt dictator, Nursultan Nazarbayev, was ousted in January. In Belarus, President Alexander Lukashenko was almost ousted following the fraudulent 2019 election. It was only because of Putin's intervention that Lukashenko is still in power. So, Putin dug into the dictator's playbook and started a war. Now, instead of the Russian people being mad at him, they can be mad at Nazified Ukrainians, or the U.S., or NATO. So far, he seems to be succeeding, with his approval ratings in Russia around 83%. It is now plain that Putin is evil. This is not breathless hyperbole, it is fact. He has no regard for human life and only lusts over power and money. In his calculus, money is power, and vice versa. Amazingly, Putin himself has now been sanctioned by the West, but finding the whereabouts of his money is no easy task. I have spent the last 14 years trying to understand the dark money flowing out of Russia. Once we found it, there was a huge price to pay. April 3, 2016, the British newspaper The Guardian published an article entitled Revealed, the $2 billion offshore trail that leads to Vladimir Putin. The author was part of a consortium of 370 journalists from 80 countries reporting on a data leak known as the Panama Papers. Central to the leak were over 11 million documents held by the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca. The files revealed financial details of hundreds of thousands of offshore companies and accounts belonging to wealthy people from around the world. The articles were divided by country, and each country had a star. In Russia, that star was a classical cellist named Sergei Roldugin. Roald Dugin was not just a cellist, but also Putin's best friend, going back to the 1970s. Even though Roald Dugin professed to drive a used car and play a second-hand cello, he controlled companies that had accumulated billions of dollars of assets since Putin took power, effectively making him the richest musician in the world. A quick Google search reveals the richest musicians are Jay-Z, Sir Paul McCartney, and Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, who are each worth around $1.25 billion. Yo-Yo Ma is probably the world's wealthiest cellist, and he's worth only about $25 million. How had Roald Dugin become so wealthy? The answer, in my opinion, is that this cellist was serving as a nominee for his longtime friend, Vladimir Putin. As anyone who follows Russia knows, Putin loves money, but because he's president, he can only earn his official salary, which is around $300,000 a year, and he cannot hold any assets beyond those he accumulated before he was in government. If he did, anyone who got hold of a copy of a bank statement or a property registry with his name on it could use it as leverage to blackmail him. Putin is well aware of this because he's used this tactic on many occasions against his own enemies. Therefore, Putin needed others to hold his money so no paper trail led back to him. For this, he needed people he could trust. In any mafia-like organization, these people are rare birds. There is no commodity more valuable than trust. Roald Dugin was one such person for Putin. From the moment the two had met on the streets of Leningrad in their 20s, they were like brothers. Roald Dugin introduced Putin to his wife. He was the godfather to Putin's firstborn daughter, and through the decades they had remained the closest of friends. For us, this news was potentially even more dramatic. If we could somehow link any of the $230 million tax refund that Sergei Magnitsky had been killed over to Putin through Roald Dugin, it would be a game changer. Pausing here in the text to read the caption of a photograph, and this is in color, but I will say a lot of black and off-white are featured. It is the headstone for lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, for whom the Magnitsky Act is named, December 7, 2012. It appears to be two large slabs set at an angle. They're black, so they may be black granite. The inscription is in Russian, so I'm unable to read it. There are dates, 08-04-1972, 16-11-2009, and there is a portrait of the head and face of Sergei Magnitsky. In the background, behind this rather tall-looking, stark, modernistic tombstone, there's a high-rise in the background in an off-gray color. The sky surrounding everything, all the tombstones in the graveyard and the high-rise and the few trees noticeable, the sky is in a grayish white. It's winter because there's snow on the ground. And there's a big vase of flowers next to the Sergei Magnitsky headstone, and they're drooping. They have wilted, frozen probably. They were once beautiful golden yellow chrysanthemums and white roses, I'm guessing. Everything's so droopy. Returning to the text now. 2 days later, an obscure Lithuanian website reported that one of the companies linked to Roald Dugin had received $800,000 from an account at a Lithuanian bank. This account belonged to a shell company called Delco Networks. We searched our money laundering database and found that this $800,000 was connected to the $230 million tax refund. After leaving Russia, the money had passed through a series of banks in Moldova, Estonia, and ultimately Lithuania. We could now link the crime that Sergei Magnitsky had exposed and been killed over to Roldugin. And from Roldugin, we could link it to Russian President Vladimir Putin. This explained everything. When Sergei was killed, Putin could have had the perpetrators of the tax rebate fraud prosecuted, but he did not. When the international community demanded justice for Sergei, Putin exonerated everyone involved. When the Magnitsky Act passed in the U.S., freezing all assets of those implicated in Sergei's murder, Putin retaliated by banning the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. Before the law passed, Putin's government had even arranged for Dmitry Klyuev, a convicted mobster, along with his conciliar, Andrei Pavlov, both private citizens, to attend the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly in Monaco to lobby against the Magnitsky Act, as if they were some sort of special government envoys. Why had Putin gone to such lengths to protect a group of crooked officials and organized criminals? Because, quite simply, he was protecting himself. Out of $230 million, $800,000 is a pittance, but sums like these add up. It's like charging $5 for a toll. For one car, it's nothing, but after a million cars, you've collected a fortune. Mossack Fonseca was merely one of hundreds of offshore trust companies. If these other companies' books were similarly exposed, I was sure we would find other trustees of Vladimir Putin who'd received other tranches of the $230 million. And this was just one crime among thousands and thousands of crimes that had taken place in Russia since Putin took power. We were looking at the tip of an enormous iceberg. The Magnitsky Act says Russian human rights violators will have their assets frozen in the West. It also says beneficiaries of the $230 million crime will be sanctioned. That Putin was a human rights violator was not in dispute, but now he ticked both boxes. The Magnitsky Act put all of his wealth and power at risk. That made him a very angry man. His crusade against the Magnitsky Act was not just philosophical, it was personal. We had genuinely hit Vladimir Putin's Achilles heel. Allow me to spell Magnitsky. That's Magnitsky. At 8 a.m. Monday, July 16, 2018, Trump and Putin were in the midst of their summit in Helsinki. I was in Aspen with my family. I set up my laptop at the end of the dining room table, a view of the mountains to the west over my shoulder. I needed to get some work done, and I did not want any distractions. My kids usually run riot all over the house, but that day I put the dining room off limits. I also put restraints on myself, laying down my phone. After 2 hours of work, I turned over my phone. The screen was flush with notifications. I had dozens of messages, texts, emails, DMs, voicemails, everything. I opened the first email. Bill, are you watching Helsinki? I scrolled through my inbox. That was the scariest, most F-space-C-K-E-D-space-up thing I've ever seen, one friend said. Another wrote, if you need a place to hide, we will put you in our mountain house. What the hell was going on? I found the earliest email about Helsinki from the journalist Ali Velshi at MSNBC. The subject was to the point. Putin is talking about you now. F space CK. I put down my phone and went online. It did not take long to find the post-summit press conference. The two leaders were on stage at twin lecterns, and their body language could not have been more different. Putin looked like he owned the place, while Trump glowered and slumped his shoulders, looking anything but presidential. The shocking moment came when a Reuters reporter asked President Putin, Will you consider extraditing the 12 Russian officials that were indicted last week by a U.S. grand jury? Robert Mueller, special counsel who'd been in charge of investigating Russian involvement in the 2016 presidential election, as well as possible Russian links to the Trump campaign, had made an unexpected announcement the week before. His office was indicting 12 Russian officers of the GRU, Russia's military intelligence wing, accusing them of hacking the Democratic National Committee and interfering in the election to help Trump win. Putin smiled and nodded confidently, looking like he'd spent the whole weekend preparing for this moment. We can meet you halfway. We can actually permit representatives of the U.S., including this very commission headed by Mr. Mueller. We can let them into the country. They can be present at questioning. In this case, there's another condition. This kind of effort should be a mutual one. We would expect the Americans would reciprocate. For instance, we can bring up Mr. Browder in this particular case. I had to watch it several times to make sure I'd heard it correctly. Somehow, Putin, standing next to the President of the United States, was suggesting swapping 12 Russian GRU officers for me. I waited for Trump's reaction. Surely he would reject this out of hand, but he did not. I think that's an incredible offer, he said, suggesting he was ready to trade me. Rationally, I understood the gravity of the situation, but emotionally, I was too shaken to take it in. It was like being in a serious car accident. I knew I had just been injured, but I had no idea how badly. As I tried to assess the damage, the main thing I kept coming back to was whether it was safe for me to stay in America. My original nebulous concern that some Russian assassin might try to kill me had now been overtaken by the very real fear that the President of the United States would hand me over to the Russians. My first inclination was to get the hell out of America. But my wife Elena calmed me down and convinced me to stay. Right now, she said, the world wants to know who is Bill Browder. She was right. I spent the rest of that day on TV, explaining the Magnitsky Act to anyone who would listen. My main message? Putin is evil. And this idea of his was nothing more than a test for the West. Would the West pass? Only time would tell. There's another photo here. I'll read the caption first. Browder testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Capitol Hill, July 27, 2017. It's mainly a headshot. The background is dark, almost black, dark brown. But there are lights on the upper edge, like spotlights, like theatrical spotlights. The person front and center, who is holding a microphone in one hand, and we see only the one hand, his dark-suited shoulders, a white shirt beneath his hand, and a dotted tie. He's partially bald. He has gray hair. He's wearing glasses. His mouth is shut. He's neither smiling, nor speaking, nor grimacing. His eyes are dark and tilted slightly upward, either at someone else or a camera. Returning to the text, the next morning at 6:30 a.m., my wife Elena jolted me awake, waving a piece of paper in my face. You've got to see this, honey. Elena's originally from Russia, and she'd gotten up before sunrise to read the Russian news. That morning, the Russian Prosecutor General's office had issued a list of 11 additional people the Russians wanted the U.S. to hand over in exchange for the 12 GRU officers. Russians love symmetry in these matters. The U.S. wanted 12, which meant Russia wanted 12. I propped myself up and took the paper. The Russians wanted Mike McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, my friend Kyle Parker, congressional staffer who originally drafted the Magnitsky Act. three special agents from the Department of Homeland Security who'd been involved in investigating a Russian money laundering scheme involving a Cyprus-registered company named Prevazon that had received some of the $230 million. Jonathan Weiner, the Washington lawyer and former State Department official who'd come up with the original idea for the Magnitsky Act. David Kramer, another ex-State Department official and former head of the human rights organization Freedom House, who had advocated for the Magnitsky Act alongside Boris Nemtsov and me. There were four additional names on the list, but the main common denominators were either involvement in the Magnitsky Act or participation in the Prevazon case. What were the Russians accusing us of? The day before, Putin alleged that my business associates and I had earned over $1.5 billion in Russia, never paid any taxes, and then, to get Trump's attention, gave $400 million as a contribution to the campaign of Hillary Clinton. The actual amount was zero. Putin went on to say, we have solid reason to believe some of intelligence officers guided these transactions. Putin was accusing Ambassador McFaul, Kyle Parker, and three DHS agents, and everyone else on the list of being part of my criminal enterprise. This was classic Russian projection. We were not the victims. They were. They were not the criminals. We were. Instead of the Dmitry Klyuev organized crime group working with corrupt Russian officials to launder vast sums of money, it was the Bill Browder organized crime group working with corrupt American officials to launder vast sums of money. It was one thing to go after a private person like me, who was not even an American citizen. Browder is British. That might have been distasteful, but in the final analysis, how many people cared about me? It was entirely different to ask for a former U.S. ambassador, a congressional staffer, and rank-and-file DHS agents. If Trump obliged Putin, it would set a disastrous precedent. The day after that, at a White House press conference, Maggie Haberman from the New York Times asked Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, is President Trump open to having U.S. officials questioned by Russia? Huckabee Sanders did not waver. She said that Trump said it was an interesting idea. He wants to work with his team and determine if there's any validity that would be helpful to the process. The tidal wave of indignation was towering, and the Senate quickly organized a vote on a resolution calling on Trump never to follow through on Putin's incredible offer. The administration could sense this wave was about to come crashing down on them. An hour before the vote, the White House finally backtracked. That afternoon, the Senate voted on the resolution. It passed 98-0. No one would be handed over to the Russians. This article is adapted from Browder's Freezing Order, a true story of money laundering, murder, and surviving Vladimir Putin's wrath, published by Simon and Schuster. From The View, The Looming Food Crisis, by Scott Irwin. Imagine driving the 600 miles between Indianapolis and Omaha. P.S. I've done it. You see field after field after field of corn and soybeans. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently projected farmers in the three states you drive across, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, will plant 56 million acres of corn and soybeans in 2022. It turns out this is roughly equivalent to the size of planted crop acreage in Ukraine. This helps put into geographic perspective the huge size of the potential crop area put at risk by the Ukraine war. So is the world facing a full-blown food crisis brought on by the conflict between Ukraine and Russia? Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, Ukraine has regained its traditional position as one of the most important breadbaskets of the world. More than 55% of Ukraine's land area is farmable, and it has some of the most productive soils on the globe. According to the USDA, Ukraine produces about 4% of global corn and wheat supplies, 7% of barley, and 31% of sunflower oil. It is not just the size of Ukrainian crop production that's worrisome for global food supplies, but the fact that so much of it is exported. Ukraine is now the fifth largest exporter of wheat in the world, supplying 10% of global wheat exports. Ukrainian farmers have fallen in love with corn and now contribute nearly 15% of global exports. Of particular concern is the destination of Ukraine's agricultural exports. In the wheat market, the main buyers include Bangladesh, Egypt, Indonesia, and Pakistan, all countries with rapidly growing populations and limited means for dealing with shortfalls. This is not as big a concern for Ukraine's corn exports, as China is its main buyer and runs a surplus. The big question is whether the impact of the Ukrainian conflict on global grain supplies is likely to be similar to a severe drought or something much worse. There's definitely the potential for the latter. A drought typically does not entirely zero out crop acreage in a major producing nation. This is where the timing of the Russian invasion is so important. The planting window for spring crops in Ukraine is basically the same as it is in the U.S. Corn Belt, April and May. Once the war started, it was easy to see it spilling into the spring planting season and severely affecting the ability of farmers to sow their crops. The obstacles that Ukrainian farmers face at the present time are certainly formidable. There's no prospect of planting spring crops in the areas with active fighting. Other parts of the country so far spared fighting still face shortages of fuel, labor, and other crop inputs, especially fertilizer. Just imagine how many Ukrainian farmers have taken up arms and are fighting somewhere in the nation right now. Going against this pessimistic view is the inherent resourcefulness of farmers. There's room for a bit of optimism on this front, given the recent pullback of Russian troops away from territories in the north. This means large chunks of Ukrainian crop production are now not as directly threatened by the fighting. But heavy fighting continues in the eastern and southern regions of Ukraine. The Ukrainian agricultural ministry surprised many by saying it expects 70% of spring crops to be planted and up to 80% if demining is completed in northern areas previously occupied by Russia. While all of Ukraine's spring crops are obviously not going to get planted, this suggests the worst-case scenarios are not likely to happen. It's now safe to assume at least half of Ukraine's spring crops will be planted, and I will not be surprised if two-thirds is planted. There's still a long way to go in terms of getting their crops out of the field. Then there's the issue of getting the crops out of the country, even if they are produced. This may turn out to be the real bottleneck. International shipping from southern Ukrainian ports along the Black Sea is at a complete standstill and is likely to remain that way as long as the war continues. It's impossible to get insurance on shipping in this area. Progress is being made in rerouting crop exports from Ukraine via rail and truck, but this is more expensive with much lower capacity. World grain markets are in the process of sending signals to producers and consumers to make needed adjustments, hence the higher prices. If Ukrainian farmers get as much of their crops planted and harvested as I think they will, then the shortfall will not be as severe as was feared. While the world may avoid a food production crisis, there's likely to be a food affordability crisis in parts of the world. Ukrainian and Russian wheat imports are a staple in the diet of many less developed nations in the Middle East and Africa. As grain markets do their job of cutting demand in the face of smaller supplies, the poor in importing countries will be priced out of the market. This does not bode well for the well-being of millions of people around the world or political stability in many less developed nations. The situation deserves careful monitoring and the provision of as much help from rich countries as can be summoned. The author of this article, Scott Irwin, is the Lawrence J. Norton Chair in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois. There's a smallish photo here. It's in color. There's very light spring green on the horizon, like a forest or a hedgerow, and above that is an icy blue sky. But on the ground, there's bright green grass, and then a patch of brown where the grass has been cultivated, torn away. And there's a man kneeling on the ground right there in that brown spot of soil that's visible. He's wearing kind of like winter clothing. He has a dark jacket and dark slacks and a stocking cap over his head. His hands are not gloved, and he wears a backpack on his back and what looks like a heavy covering on his chest. And here's the caption. A farmer wears a bulletproof vest during crop sowing 30 kilometers from the front line in the Zaporizhia region in southeastern Ukraine. Here's a short article under the heading Health, A New Drug Epidemic by Joseph Friedman, MD, PhD candidate at UCLA, and Philippe Bourgeois, professor at UCLA. A New Drug Epidemic. There's a new drug beginning to spread rapidly through the street drug supply in the U.S., xylazine. X-Y-L-A-Z-I-N-E, an animal tranquilizer, increasingly used as a synthetic cutting agent for opioids like heroin. We recently published a study based on years of research which found that xylazine is popping up in cities all over the country. Xylazine is almost never seen by itself. Instead, it is typically added to drug formulations containing fentanyl, a family of powerful opioids made in underground labs. Over the past 10 years, synthetically produced fentanyl, a particularly addictive drug, has largely taken over the illicit opioid market. Combined with poor quality controls inherent to clandestine supply chains, this has ushered in the deadliest overdose crisis in recorded history. The U.S. now has an overdose death rate more than double the second highest country, Estonia, and nearly 20 times the global average. Consumers are drawn to fentanyl for its powerful psychoactive effects, but fentanyl is very short-acting, and keeping cravings at bay can require injecting up to 5 or 6 times per day, rather than perhaps just 2 or 3 if using heroin. This is where xylazine comes in. It extends the effect of fentanyl, or as this is often put on the street, it gives it legs. Adding xylazine to a hit can postpone cravings and withdrawal symptoms for twice as long as fentanyl alone. Its risks are substantial. As xylazine and other synthetics spread nationally, we must use evidence-based strategies like harm reduction to counter the most lethal drug crisis in recorded history. The coronavirus brief by Tara Law, health reporter. The verdict is in. During the last Omicron-driven spike in COVID-19 cases, those who received a booster shot of an mRNA vaccine were more strongly protected against hospitalization and severe disease than those who did not. It is less certain if that level of vaccination will continue to protect people from severe disease, or if boosters must be altered to address new variants. These questions were among the issues raised at the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee meeting in April, which grappled with an overall problem. Will our vaccine efforts always have to play catch-up to new variants and outbreaks, or is there a strategy to get ahead of the virus? Short term, scientists are still debating whether to widely recommend a second booster of an mRNA vaccine, that is, a fourth shot overall. Studies in both the lab and the real world show protection provided by vaccines wanes over time, and based on this evidence, the FDA authorized a second booster for anyone over 50 and for immunocompromised people over 12, March 29. Some public health experts think it makes sense to extend that recommendation to everyone. Others are not so sure, noting that the current strategy of pursuing new waves with more boosters of the same vaccines is unsustainable and will not provide durable protection that can withstand different variants. Many FDA committee members suggested an approach where people would get a multi-vaccine booster shot targeting a range of variants to provide longer-lasting immunity. Studies of such boosters are now underway. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. For the first few years of Barack Obama's presidency, the White House persuaded immigration activists to hold their fire. The incoming team had to first rebuild the economy and make sure automakers did not shutter after the 2008 financial meltdown. Then came a massive health care reboot, then Supreme Court nominations, a Republican takeover of Congress, and the president's own reelection. And then, there always seemed to be something keeping immigration from the front burner. By the time it finally emerged as a priority, Obama was in his second term and politically lame by D.C. standards. The immigration lobby labeled him the deporter-in-chief, and relationships broke down. So why does this history matter in Washington right now? As gun violence prevention groups work to build support, they are studying what happens when allies give an administration a pass. And they do not like the historical precedent of deferring to the White House, especially one whose power may have an expiration date. Biden is a friend to the movement, sure. We can call him that. But he is not a leader, and that's what we really need, says Zenot Yahya of March for Our Lives, the youth movement that emerged in the wake of the 2018 high school shooting in Parkland, Florida. March for Our Lives, Guns Down America, and Change the Ref, April 8, published Biden's report card on gun violence, and the grade is a D+. The timing was matched to the one-year anniversary of Biden standing in the Rose Garden with an agenda to curb mass shootings. The reality is, a year later, that commitment has proven to be false, says Igor Volsky, the co-founder and executive director of Guns Down America. In conversations with leaders of these groups, it is clear this is not the verdict they wanted to deliver. But Biden, who was the Obama era's in-house expert on guns, has clearly come up short on his promises to curb gun violence. If the White House does not see the looming political threat of a fractured coalition, they should. After all, it was not that long ago that some current administration officials were protesting Obama's immigration policies at the White House gates. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. After Imran Khan, Pakistan resets. Following weeks of political turmoil, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan is out, Shehbaz Sharif is in, and the country's streak of political dysfunction continues. No elected prime minister has ever served a full five-year term, though Khan is the first to be removed by a vote of no confidence in Parliament. This sad statistic is explained by constant infighting among the nation's political factions, a culture of official corruption, and frequent interventions of military leaders determined to protect their prerogatives. Khan is spelled K-H-A-N, Sharif, S-H-A-R-I-F. Many of those who voted for the charismatic Khan in 2018 hoped he might end these cycles of failure. He came from neither the Bhutto nor Sharif factions, the dynasties that had dominated Pakistan's modern politics. His status as a genuine political outsider gave credibility to his campaign pledge to attack the country's endemic graft. He also appeared to have the blessing of the perpetually meddlesome military. But 4 years later, Khan has fallen victim to tough economic times. Inflation, including for food, is hitting record highs. Unemployment is high. Debts and deficits are rising. But his increasingly controversial foreign policy also played a big role in his ouster by helping to poison his relationship with Pakistan's military brass. The generals have long signaled that good working relationships with both China and the U.S. are critical to Pakistan's security. They know China is the more reliable long-term ally against India, Pakistan's chief rival, and that Chinese investment remains crucial for the future of Pakistan's economy. But they also know the U.S. and EU are Pakistan's lead export markets, and that good relations with the International Monetary Fund, in which the U.S. plays a crucial role, are important for Pakistan's economic well-being. Imran Khan appeared headed in another direction. In recent weeks, he tried to boost his popularity by playing to the anti-American hostility of his core voters. He set off alarm bells in Washington and among Pakistan's generals with a visit to Vladimir Putin in Moscow on the first day of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That trip was long planned, and its purpose was to secure badly needed Russian natural gas for Pakistan's economy. But Khan has done little to discourage the suspicion that he is a fan of Russia's president. His government then abstained from voting to condemn Russia's invasion. When his parliamentary coalition began to fracture, and it appeared the military supported a bid by lawmakers to oust him via a vote of no confidence, Khan blamed a conspiracy led by the West, by which he surely meant the U.S., to push him aside in favor of someone Washington likes better. Now he is out. The new prime minister, Shehbaz Sharif, represents a reversion to the old Pakistan, according to Khan and his supporters. Sharif is the 70-year-old younger brother of former PM Nawaz Sharif. He's also a veteran politician and a former chief minister of Punjab. His primary task will be to try to restore the nation's economic stability at a time when broader threats to the global economy will continue to create obstacles. But this new government will also return foreign policy to the old Pakistan model by working hard at the increasingly daunting task of keeping good relations with both America and China. Ideas for a sustainable future, and this short article will probably be abridged. Four new members of Time's 2030 committee, part of a project marking this decade's progress toward a better world, offer solutions for change. This is by Hiro Mizuno, M-I-Z-U-N-O, UN Special Envoy on Innovative Finance and Sustainable Investments. Financial institutions must do the work. Finance is indispensable to the achievement of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, SDG, which address issues from climate change to inequality. Without capital, no business or government can hope to achieve these goals. At COP26, 450 major financial institutions committed to making their portfolios net zero by 2050, meaning they will require any company they invest in to eliminate or offset their carbon footprint. The $130 trillion they collectively manage may sound like more than enough capital to solve sustainability issues. However, a fraction of that is being put to this use. The OECD estimates $2.5 trillion is needed annually to achieve the SDGs, two-thirds of which must be invested in developing countries. Just 10% is currently being invested. The financial ecosystem is sophisticated, comprising many different interdependent players who cannot change the system alone. No asset manager can build a carbon-neutral portfolio unless their customers demand net-zero indexes. Similarly, banks cannot finance projects in developing countries without rating agencies offering fair credit ratings and regulators taking a progressive approach. At COP26, we heard an unprecedented appeal from financial institutions for regulatory intervention. Governments should seize this opportunity to accelerate change. To achieve their commitments and subsequently the SDGs, all players must have open dialogue and hold one another accountable to produce and adhere to concrete action plans. Investors are urging CEOs to do more than maximize shareholders' value. Investors must also fulfill a greater responsibility than simply optimizing financial returns by acting as stewards of the entire financial ecosystem. For their portfolios to become sustainable, the financial system and wider economic system must be sustainable. That extends to the societies and environments we live in. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.